From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special report on the continuing unrest in the United States over police violence. Tensions remain high across the U.S. in the wake of yet another and a continuing stream of cases of police shootings of young black men. The most recent case, the killing of 18-year-old Antonio Martin in Berkeley, Missouri, near Ferguson, has again raised questions about the failure to deliver first aid to the shooting victim. RT's Marina Portnaya reports from Berkeley, Missouri.
A U.S. city remains on edge in the wake of another police shooting. The incident met with two nights of protests in Berkeley, Missouri, as demonstrators and cops clashed on the streets.
Get off the lawn! Get off the lawn!
Officials insist the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Antonio Martin shouldn't be compared with the case of Michael Brown in nearby Ferguson. That's because Brown was unarmed, while, according to police, Martin pointed a 9mm handgun at the white officer who was questioning him.
The mayor of Berkeley says initial evidence suggests that the white officer acted appropriately when he shot Antonio Martin Tuesday evening. Not only do many residents disagree with that conclusion, but many are very angered over the way the teenager's body was treated following the fatal shooting.
They should have called an ambulance, or someone could have rushed him to the hospital.
Martin's best friend, who asked us not to use his real name, rushed to the gas station shortly after the teenager was shot Tuesday at 11:15 p.m. According to reports, police used partitions to conceal Martin's body until it was removed from the scene more than 2 hours later at 1:40 a.m.
The way that they left him and they picked him up and put him in a van and just drove off with him, he wasn't, I think that's totally disrespectful. I believe that he could have still been alive afterwards if he was rushed to the emergency room that's less than a half a mile down the road.
RT reached out to the St. Louis Police Department to find out why Martin wasn't immediately rushed to the hospital. No one was available for comment. Police treatment of the deceased has been criticized in other cases, too. Unarmed teenager Michael Brown laid in the streets of Ferguson for 4 hours before police removed his body. A chokehold by an NYPD officer ended the life of 43-year-old Eric Garner. Nobody, not even the medical officials on the scene, came to the immediate aid of the father of five. It's a lack of basic care that seems to be playing out again and again, and it's making locals very nervous indeed.
Right now, just very tense between the police and the people and everything, and I'm scared. I'm scared of police. I'm honest. I'm going to say it honest to God. I'm scared.
Marina Portnaya, RT, Berkeley, Missouri.
The disparate treatment of police victims of violence and the victims of police violence is evident not just in the delivery of first aid, although it is evident there. Michael Brown received no first aid, and his body was left on the sidewalk for 4 hours in the summer sun. Eric Garner received no first aid, even though there were at least a half dozen police on the scene when he was killed. And Antonio Martin was left to bleed to death over a 30-minute period before he received first aid. However, video of the incident revealed that several ambulance and EMS crews, along with a number of other units, responded to the scene of the two NYPD officers within 2 minutes. The response from the media and elected officials has likewise been heavily slanted towards police. 2 days after the killings of the two NYPD officers, New York City's mayor called on protesters to halt their activities until after the funerals were held.
I'm asking everyone, and this is across the spectrum, to put aside protests, put aside demonstrations. Until these funerals are passed, let's focus just on these families and what they have lost.
But Nate Hamilton, the brother of Dontre Hamilton, a 31-year-old homeless man who was shot 14 times by Milwaukee police officer Christopher Manny on April 30th after allegedly swinging a police baton at him, said it is police and not the victims of police violence who should stop their activities.
We don't have to be that voice of reason. My family doesn't have to be that voice of reason to come out and say no violence. We don't. You know who has to be that voice of reason? The mayor has to be that voice of reason. The police chief has to be that voice of reason. The district attorney has to be the voice of reason. Not my family. Not any family that has to go through an injustice. Do we have to tell the people to calm? The people have been calm.
These disparities take place in a legal climate where, on the one hand, it is statistically nearly impossible to get even an indictment of a police officer for killing a black person, while those charged with killing a police officer faced enhanced sentencing, which includes the death penalty. For more on this, we spoke with Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report.
Well, we could look at it from a variety of angles. Let's look at the way the police treat themselves and want to be treated. Remember that they are, in fact, an army of occupation, certainly when they are in the black community. They are carrying on a war, self-consciously carrying on a war against black America, sometimes called a war on drugs or a war on crime. It's a war on black America. And they see themselves as soldiers in a war who are heroes, and you hear them refer to themselves constantly as heroes. They give themselves the credit that would be due soldiers who are fighting a just war and behaving heroically. And so they want to be pampered like heroes from a just war, with all the pomp and ceremony and outsized respect that one would give a war hero. But we have to see that in the context of them being at war, a war against us. From our standpoint, I think that we should see the treatment of Michael Brown, leaving his body literally almost baking in the sun for hours, as, in fact, a kind of lynching. Lynching was not just executed for the purpose of killing the victim. It was to create a public display of the power of the mob, often consisting of police officers as well as white civilians. And so it was a ritual of debasement, an organized expression of collective disrespect for the people that the victim came from. And it was a tool of terror. So it was not just incidental to mutilate the body and burn the body and fill the body full of holes and hang it high from a tree so that thousands of spectators could be observant and take part in the ceremony. The ceremony and the ritual itself was the point, not just the simple act of killing, which could be accomplished in no time. So that's what Michael Brown's body represented. That's what the smile on the face of the guy, the cop who choked to death, Eric Garner, that's what that represented. It was not innocent or nervous. It was a display of utter contempt for the people. That's the way we ought to look at the attitude that cops display to black bodies, dead or alive. In terms of due process, and I know that's a legal term, and the movement shouldn't get buried in legalisms, but due process is important. And just as it only took two seconds between the time that the cop in Cleveland laid eyeballs on that 12-year-old with a toy pistol and the cop shooting that kid dead, what kind of due process can take place in 2 seconds? What does that mean about the respect for life that that cop was exhibiting? And the fact that that cop was not indicted by a grand jury, the cop, a grand jury that decided that this was within the range of acceptable police procedure, means that that grand jury was instructed in such a way by the prosecutor to believe that all cops should behave that way with black people, including black children, and give them only 2 seconds of consideration before they can be put to death. And that is part of a ritual as well.
You know, I'm thinking about also the culture, which is largely driven by the media here, at least the public culture is essentially the media, and the disparate treatment that's given, say, the families of the police officers who were killed, who were treated with kid gloves, provided with public relations agents by the PBA, and speaking to very sympathetic, speaking in soft tones, reporters, or in any event, agents of the media outlets, as opposed to them being all over the stepfather of Michael Brown and almost railroading him into prison for, you know, expressing anger at the time they found out that nothing, you know, the killing of Michael was going to be an act of, you know, another act of impunity, essentially. How is it that with a cultural environment and a media environment like that, people can learn about the disparities that exist between really the public and police, but in particular communities of color and police?
Well, of course, the corporate media is the biggest actor in the heroification of the police. They're the ones who have the power to proclaim all the men and women in blue to be automatically heroes. That all of those who die while after punching in the clock somehow have heroically passed away. But I think it goes much deeper. There certainly was a consensus among white people with in the aftermath of the civil rights movement, which did destroy legal apartheid, that something had to be done to control these Negroes who were no longer bound by the tradition of apartheid and its legal racial complaints. And something that needed to be done was prison and the creation of what we call the mass black incarceration state. The speed with which this mass incarceration regime spread across the country was absolutely phenomenal, and it was with the broad support of the white population, which kept on putting these so-called law and order politicians who were building more and more prisons at breakneck speed, putting them into office, so that we saw the disparities in incarceration, which have always existed in the United States, skyrocket to fantastic numbers very, very quickly, whether those localities were places where there were large black populations or very small black populations. We saw it occur north, south, east, and west, all within a couple of years, so that now the United States accounts for one quarter of all of the prison inmates in the world, and African Americans account for one out of eight of every prison inmate on the planet. Truly a remarkable transformation of the country through the criminal justice system with the acclamation of the white public. So it's not just the corporate media, and it's not just the cops' the self-image. It's also an expression of deep, pervasive, and endemic racism in U.S. society itself. Remember, the lynch mobs were comprised of thousands of people who often brought their children and picnic baskets to observe the schedule, the spectacle, as if it were some kind of racial holiday.
You know, looking at it historically, Jim Crow came after emancipation as a response to it. And then you had at least the formal dismantling of Jim Crow in the 60s, 50s, 60s, early 70s, even 40s, 50s, 60s, early 70s. And then this response. How would you compare both the response itself just as a response, and then, say, the advances in social control technology from one era to the other?
In terms of post-emancipation, every school kid is taught about the black codes that were instituted in the old Confederacy immediately upon cessation of armed hostilities in the Civil War. What's not talked about is the role of the police in that post-Civil War Southern environment. Two of the biggest riots, actually they were police massacres of that period, and in fact the inauguration of the era of the white police riot occurred in New Orleans in 1866 and shortly thereafter in Memphis. And in both of those massacres, hundreds of black folks were killed directly by these white police forces, which were comprised, by the way, almost entirely of Irish cops. Most people think of the cops of that era, the Irish cop of that era, being in New York and Boston, but the same demographic also existed in New Orleans and Memphis. So we see the police, right after emancipation, moving to the fore in terms of repression of the newly freed slaves. We see in 1968, with the passage of the Omnibus Crime Bill, a bill signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson, who was supposed to be such a friend of black and poor people. One of the key features of that Omnibus Crime Bill was creation of the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, whose job it was to funnel millions and millions of dollars to city and county police departments all over the country so that they would be in a better and more militarized position to deal with these newly freed Negroes, that is, newly freed from the apartheid, former apartheid state. So the imposition of this militarization of the police, of a national policy of, in many cases, doubling and tripling the police forces within a very short period of time, that came right on the heels of the passage of the final of the series of Civil Rights Acts. So the United States kicks the police into the forefront of repression every time there is an opening in terms of its black population's promise of increased freedoms.
And meanwhile, now we're seeing a new activism and what looks like the formation of a movement again. This is some 45 years later now, 46 years after 1968, that seemed unstoppable, with some qualifications, you know, just knowing history in this country. Now, with the killing of two police officers, and which actually was preceded a few days earlier by an overt public relations campaign by NYPD, the I Can Breathe / you know, the whole Thank You NYPD PR campaign that they were starting, that they're going on the offensive. Is this the kernel of another response like that, do you think?
Well, the police, frankly, in New York City are talking mutiny. I think that that the police union chief's remarks about Mayor de Blasio somehow having the blood of cops on his hands is a not very veiled threat against not just the person of the mayor, but against civilian authority over the police itself. We also saw on the police message boards, not just rank-and-file police, but apparently and not just union officials, but apparently some in the chain of command of the police who were advising officers not to respond to incidents unless they could double up the number of units that were part of the response, and urging police to double up their numbers even against the orders of the brass. That is, admonitions to the police to take responsibility for deploying themselves rather than operate under the supervision of civilian authorities. That's mutiny. And when you're talking about a police force as big as New York City's with 35,000 members, that's the equivalent of three light infantry divisions. And if you have insubordination and mutiny from three infantry divisions, that's not just a mutiny. That sounds like a coup. The political establishment in New York City certainly is behaving as if they've been threatened with a coup, because they have backtracked and capitulated to the police line in the wake of the killings and the threats by the police entirely, and have responded by urging the protesters, who of course had nothing to do with the lone gunman's fateful and solitary decision, urging the protesters to tone down their rhetoric. What kind of rhetoric are they trying to eliminate? The very conversation that we should be having about the legitimacy of the way the criminal justice system operates in the United States and the legitimacy of using the police to paper over the deep economic and social contradictions that exist in the United States.
Yeah, let's go to that. This is all happening within the context of a disintegrating economy, or in any event, a disintegrating economic order. The institutionalization of poverty across broad sectors of the population and the reintroduction of a lot of working class whites to that condition, and an almost total evaporation of the middle class. The social unrest that is not so latent has bubbled a few times. We saw the middle class, or we used to be middle class, phenomenon of Occupy, for example, spring up three, four years ago. And that, although it was suppressed as a movement, it has still disseminated a number of skilled organizers out into the population where this unrest exists. And this takes place in an international context where, you know, in the so-called first world, conditions are, I would say, almost pre-revolutionary, particularly in southern Europe, because you've had this austerity forced down. And it's, again, a condition of this economic, disintegration. How do you see, first, do you see a self-conscious role by police and law enforcement generally in the United States in suppressing that, directly? In other words, working in tandem with the ruling class to maintain their position. And in any event, do you see almost open warfare between the police and the population at some point in the future?
We can make the direct connection between U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy. The United States, in terms of its foreign policy, its place in the world, can no longer hold sway simply based upon the power of its economy, which is in decline, or the softer power of its example, which no one any longer respects. So in foreign policy, the United States relies almost entirely on its military in order to coerce the rest of the world, which is why we have wars not just popping up but being instigated by the United States all over the world because it can't rule any other way. In the same way, domestically, the U.S. Economy and ruling class structures can no longer buy off large segments of the society through employments or other even racial emoluments, giving white folks a bigger cut of the pie because the pie shrinks due to their imposition of austerity. So increasingly, they must rule through the use of force, through the police. And that's why not just the Pentagon, but to an even larger extent, Homeland Security transfers billions of dollars in weapons and militarized gear and all kinds of training programs to the local police, because increasingly that's the only way they can rule. And because of the particular history of the United States, that comes down hardest on Black America. That's why Black America is and should be in the forefront of this new movement for social justice.
Speaking to the issue of the loss of soft power, internationally, the United States always sold itself as a democracy and as a prosperous one. So people wanted to come here because the streets were lined with gold and because they could escape the ancient oppressions of their homelands. That was the mythology, in any event, widely believed around the world. And domestically, as you pointed out, the American dream that was held out as an incentive for people to stay wedded to the system, people have woken up from that dream, found that it's a nightmare, and that the various things available for self-improvement, for a life of comfort, are no longer available. And the myth of American democracy is even evaporated here. People have single-digit, positive numbers for Congress, for example. With a crisis of credibility like that, how can the U.S. government, while U.S. power internationally is waning, sustain itself in power? Or how can the real power sustain itself in power?
Only by the power of the hammer, police domestically, and the military internationally, and especially internationally. The bankruptcy of U.S. soft power, of the power of example, is utterly complete. Here we have the United States backing outright, clear fascist forces in Ukraine. And although most Americans don't know it because of the role played by the corporate media here, every European knows that the U.S. backs the fascists in Ukraine. And every person in the Arab and Muslim world knows that the United States backs the jihadist forces that it has bankrolled and maneuvered in Libya and now in Syria, and that are now spreading southward in Africa. This is common knowledge. So U.S. soft power is gone entirely. That's why we have an AFRICOM actually carrying out the duties that used to be reserved to the U.S. State Department in Africa, because everything is now militarized in terms of U.S. dealings with the outside world, and we see the domestic counterpart in terms of the militarization of the police here at home. They have nothing to offer except one end or the other of a gun.
What should people be working on?
Well, we used to say, workers of the world, unite. I think at this stage in history, when U.S. imperialism threatens the very sovereignty of every other nation, when U.S. imperialism poses a threat to the prosperity and existence and certainly the independent action of even the upper classes and the capitalist classes of other countries, that we can now revise the slogan in terms of the war against imperialism to people of the world unite against Wall Street and its subsidiaries.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.